The first speaker in this session is Bob Wilson on the obvious topic.
Right.
Just over 51 years ago, Arno Penzias and I had put together our decision radiometer that we've been working on for a little over a year to make measurements of the 20-foot orbital flares. And this was when we took this record, and initially it was a big disappointment. Because what it showed was that the 20-foot orbital flare antenna temperature was much higher than what we expected. We had planned to make a series of precision measurements using this setup. And we were rather disappointed that the first result seemed to be a problem. But in retrospect, of course, this messy looking record is our first evidence of the cosmic microwave background radiation. In this talk, I will discuss how we got to this point, how the source of excess noise was identified, and some thoughts looking back. I'd like to start the story in 1928, when Art Crawford and Carl Jansky were hired at Bell Labs in Holmdel. For a time, they roomed together. More about Art a little later. Carl Jansky, of course, you know about using this thing, identifying noise from the Galactic Center, starting radio astronomy. Unfortunately, he died young before radio from a chronic medical condition before radio astronomy had really blossomed into being a big science. The group at Holmdel, in addition to working on high frequency radio transmission, later in the 30s started working on microwave relay. And I guess you can tell from this picture that one of their first antennas was a horn lens, but after the first couple of installations after the war, they went over to horn reflectors. And microwave relays used horn reflectors for essentially the rest of the Bell system's use of microwave relays. And that's in about 1950 when national TV came to Houston. That's how we got this one. In parallel with that, the first transmission through a waveguide had been shown in the early 30s. And shortly after that, some mathematical work showed that it would be possible to have a very low wall submodulated waveguide, TE01, which could be used for long-distance transmission. And over the years, the group at Holmdel was working toward the goal of a very wide-band, millimeter wave transmission system based on waveguide running across the country. When I joined Bell Labs in 1963, such a system was under intensive development. They were going to use a 2-inch diameter waveguide to transmit frequencies between 38 and 120 gigahertz. Arno and I borrowed a receiver, low noise Schottky barrier diode receiver, from that system to discover carbon monoxide in their solid space using the physics experiment on TP. Well, I think Jack Welch is actively going to talk about molecules, so I won't say anything more about molecules. John Pierce, skipping ahead to the 50s, John Pierce was a polymath at Bell Labs who got up into management and liked to go around and insert ideas in various places. started what I think is probably the first computer music group. And he also wrote science fiction under the pseudonym of J.J. Cutler. And in 1955, John Pierce published a paper in Jet Propulsion entitled Orbital Radio Relays. Apparently, he was unaware of Arthur Clarke's extraterrestrial relays, published 10 years earlier than our artist wrote. So in 1957, when Sputnik was launched, it got his attention. And in 1958, NASA proposed to put up the Echo balloon, a half millimolar, 100-foot diameter balloon, to measure forces in orbit. Bell Labs rather quickly proposed using Echo as a first communication satellite. It would not be very useful. The return signal would be weak, and it couldn't have very wide bandwidth. But it would be a way of learning about Earth stations, how you track satellites, and really getting the feedback without being... so that when the real thing came along, they know how to do it. So since the return signal was going to be small, very weak, they decided to use two Bell Labs inventions. One, a Ruby traveling wave laser amplifier with noise temperature of about 4 Kelvin. And since any ordinary parabola would have enough spillover to way override that amount of noise, it would use a hard reflector antenna, which should have almost no ground pair. So it could make a very long low noise system that way. Art Crawford led the construction of the 20-foot orbital reflector. Bell Labs proposed using Echo. NASA supported it, and Echo was launched and used as a microwave relay in 1960. Eisenhower's voice was sent over it. Broadcast from JPL, received at home Bell, put on a radio, on a landline link, and broadcast to many radio stations. Telstar was the first active communication satellite which was being developed during this time. After Echo, the 20-foot Hornet reflector was fitted with a 40 GHz receiver and had a backup on it. It didn't do very much. So, in 1957, I went to Caltech for a PhD in physics. Sputnik was launched that October. It seemed like an important thing, but I don't think I realized how important it was going to be for me. I joined the new radio astronomy group at Caltech, which had just finished the heavy construction for the first Golden Valley conditions. My one cosmology course was taught by Sir Fred Hoyle, and philosophically I rather like the steady state theory. In my thesis, I used one of the 90-foot antennas because we didn't have a pipe connected together. It was an over-the-summer project started by John Bolden. The idea was to point the antenna to the west of the Milky Way that the Earth's rotation scaled across. If you look in that picture, you won't see any computers in that room, but you will see two chart recorders. So as time went along, you would see it would go up as we went over the Milky Way and back down. Rip off the chart, put it on the drawing table, get the meter stick, draw a baseline, and measure around that. Clearly, this wasn't quite right because we're inside the galaxy. There's no such thing as looking away from the galaxy. And besides, on the edges of the map, I can see a slight pop. Anyway, the Milky Way is very thin compared to its diameter, so it worked pretty well as a survey of radiation from the plane, and I got my PhD. After finishing my PhD, when you were a postdoc, I took a job at Bell Labs, Crawford Bell Lab in 1963. They had a Homedale group had been evicted from their original location to build a much larger Homedale building, the Earl Sarandon building, which you heard about a little bit earlier. Anyway, this was a new building. Arnold Penzias had been hired a little bit earlier. He had finished a PhD with Charlie Collins at Columbia. Radio astronomy also. So why did Bell Labs hire two radio astronomers? I think for several reasons. One, they probably told the management we would know about large antennas, signals through the atmosphere, noise temperature, very useful things for satellite communication. But I think there was more. I think Mark Crawford and Rudy Conker, who had worked on this receiving system for ECHO, out of what they had put together, wanted to see it used for something more than just a one-off experiment with the ECHO satellite. I think there was also a residual feeling that Bell Labs had failed to follow up on Janssen's discovery earlier, and that doing something for radio astronomy then would be a good thing. So Arnold and I had used larger antennas. But we knew that the 20-foot Horn reflector had some unique properties. It was small enough that we could get in the far field and measure its gain, but with the traveling wave laser, it was sensitive enough to make very good measurements. And it would have very little pickup from the ground, so it could make an absolute brightness measurement. So Arnold and I put together a series of observations we thought we would like to make, where we had an advantage or no one else was working. The first was to measure the flux of Cas A at 4 gigahertz. This would be useful for radio astronomers. It's 10 of those radio astronomers in those days didn't understand the gain of their antenna. And there was sort of a separate effort to calibrate some standard sources. We could end it there. It would also be useful for satellite communications. By an Earth station, you look at the signal-to-noise ratio on Cas A, and you know how good the Earth station was. Then we would build a 21-centimeter receiver and look for a halo of radiation around the galaxy. And establish a zero point for Milky Way radiation. In other words, fix up my thesis. Using the same 21 centimeters system, we could do a much better search for atomic hydrogen clusters of galaxies, which was Arnold's thesis. We could fix it up, his up too. And there were several other things we were going to do that we don't need to mention at this point. So Dave Hogg and I rented a helicopter for a day and flew a 4 gigahertz source on the helicopter, had the poor guy stay in a stationary position as best he could. We pointed at it and compared the signal from the 20-foot horn and that from a reference antenna. Then Arlo and I got our system together and made this record, and
at this point we see the antenna at 90 degrees elevation. This is the whole mode with low-headed attenuation. From the numbers down here, we calculate how much noise was added above the helium, and it should have had a thermal temperature about 5 pounds. So the antenna was considerably hotter than the helium. I mean, we had expected exactly the opposite. It should be colder. Excess noise had been seen before at low mass, but we could now trace it directly to the antenna or the sky beyond. Ed Oman, making the system for ECHO, had added up all the components of his receiver, noise, and all the components, and made a system measurement, regularly saw system temperature, I think it was 2.3 Kelvin, 1 Kelvin higher than what he could add up. But he thought his total uncertainty added up all the components was so large that he couldn't claim anything about that. So we spent about 9 months improving our receiver, checking that several ways of calibrating it gave the same answer, and finally making the CAS-A and some other radios for measurements very accurate. During that time, the excess noise of 3.5 Kelvin was always present, didn't change, and we could find no fault in our equipment or the environment to explain it. So after completing the CAS-A measurement, we started cleaning up some parts of the antenna, which we not wanted to disturb our neighbor. Including removing a pair of hinges and their droppings, and putting tape over the joints between the separate sections of the antenna, just in case there was resistive loss in there. So, very shortly afterward, we had ruled out essentially all of the sources we could think of. I won't go through them all. But then one spring day in 1965, Arnold called Bernie Burke. And neither one of them remembers what the initial conversation was about. But at the end of the conversation, Bernie said, "What's going on with your crazy experiment?" The background to that is that somewhat earlier, they had been on a plane together to Canada for some meeting, and Bernie was figuring out what the two of us were going to do with our lives. And Arnold had listed the various projects we had, and Bernie said, there's no halo around the galaxy. We're wasting the time. I guess one thing I forgot to say earlier is, of course, if this is all at 4 gigahertz, where we expected the galaxy to not be producing any significant radiation. And we were later going to do the actual measurement at 1.4 gigahertz. So I don't know later on the but we had lots of extra antenna temperature. We had no explanation for it. How could we possibly make a measure? So Bernie said, "Call up Bob Dickey at Princeton." And Dickey, of course, had done microwave work during the war and then the Dickey radiometer. And then had gotten interested in gravity theory and had started looking into the Big Bang for the universe. And he realized that he was thinking of a multiple Big Bang and that there would be, the universe would be very hot after first contraction. It would be full of radiation, and as the universe expanded, the radiation would cool off and become microwaves. And therefore, he got two graduate students, two very good graduate students. Dave Wilkinson, he asked to make a receiver to look for something, and Jim Peebles to do some theory and try to figure out how bright it is this thing that Dave Wilkinson is going to look for. And the same so, it's probably easier to do the theory than to build an experiment. And Jim finished early. And then he got an invitation from Johns Hopkins to give a talk. So he went to Dave and asked if he could give a talk about the Big Bang and radiation left over. They said, "Sure, we're so far ahead, nobody can catch up with us now." So we went off, gave the talk. Ken Turner heard the talk. He was a good friend of Arnold Burke. He told Bernie, and then Arnold called shortly after. So Arnold did call Bob Dickey, and Dave Wilkinson tells the story that they were having a bag lunch in Dickey's office discussing things. The phone rang. Dickey picked up the phone. They heard things like atmospheric radiation, antenna temperature, all the things they were thinking about. And their ears really pricked up. And the phone, they had to put the phone down. He said, "Boys, you've been scooped." I think Bell Labs have a pretty good reputation. Well, Arnold and I were happy to have any kind of explanation, since we believed in physics. This noise had to come from somewhere. We run out of ideas for it might come from. But we didn't really think of cosmology as explaining anything. So, we and Nikki's group wrote two separate papers and submitted them to the Astrophysical Journal. Soon, three different groups remembered that CN had been seen in the fusing of solar clouds, and it was seen not only from the ground state, but from the first rotation of the excited state, and the excitation was approximately 3 degrees. Near the end of the year, Wilkinson and Roll put the receiver together, made a measurement which pretty much agreed with ours. So after a year, the Rayleigh-Jeans part of the black body curve was pretty well filled in. Certainly more precision work to be done. But I think Arnold and I felt that the thing that was really necessary would be to go over the peak. That didn't seem to be something that we would be able to do. We didn't actually do much more on the background. There's a Cody spectrum, and the current picture of the universe and picture right now. Obviously, you've heard enough today that it's become very important. I'm here to tell you that those two guys in 1965 didn't understand what the big thing that comes with background radiation is going to be. Looking back on this, I feel extremely lucky that I had a job at Bell Labs and was supported to apply technologies that Bell Labs produced for communications to astrophysics. There were also many experts at Bell Labs who were quite happy to help with any problem that might arise. I was also lucky that I started my career when radio astronomy and cosmology were relatively new sciences and were poised to blossom as technology developed. Also, I think when I entered the workforce, the nation, perhaps somewhat shocked by Sputnik, and remembering the contributions of science to World War II, were willing to commit resources to being leaders in science and technology in the world. So as you may have gathered from what I said, there was no real aha moment in discovering the cosmic background radiation. The importance only became obvious over the years as there was an interaction between theoretical predictions and better receivers. And as we got to lower noise, and people thought more about cosmology, it grew on itself. And now, of course, it's quite central to cosmology. So it's very satisfying to look back and see that we did our job right, and to see how much has been derived from cosmic background radiation. It's been a great ride.
Any questions?
I don't know if this is a question or not, and if it is, whether it's to you or to Johnson, but persistence in both cases.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Would you agree somewhat similar?
I felt so taught I might have given. We've been very similar to Johnson's time. We've had a lot of the same experience.
didn't have any problem with the manageables. His lower round results, because they didn't know much about me at this time. In many other ways, I think that successful, being careful when you see something that you didn't expect, follow up on it, and also the fact there were many precursor measurements each might have made in the summer. There's a particularly interesting story about George Field, which I was talking about. He had all across campus and oxygen tools.
Justin?
Well, I think there's a further comment, but I don't wish to be rude, and that is not knowing too much astrophysics. So you
yes.
don't know what's impossible.
Yes. I think I had a certain amount of that since I got into astrophysics on the late 90s. Okay.